The question isn't so much what is worth fearing. The question is, what is the antidote to fear? And the only antidote Dunn can come up with is trust. Because I've got two choices. I can either fear God or I can fear everything else. And I just don't have the energy to fear everything else. So I'm going to fear God.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. No man is an island, entire of itself. Each is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thine own or of thy friends were. Each man's death diminishes me. Therefore, send not to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Welcome back, podcast listeners. Quite a Lenten poem, eh? For Western listeners, we are in the last week of Lent before Holy Week, first week of Lent for our Eastern brethren and sistren. So meeting here in Lententide, I thought it would be a good time for a conversation about someone who has reflected deeply on sin, suffering, pain, and the faithful presence of God. Well, two people, actually. The 17th century priest and poet, John Donne, whose famous poem we opened with, and author, Philip Yancey. The poem that I read at Open is actually an excerpt from a longer work called Devotions that some of you might have read. It's a really beautiful book. Donne wrote it from his sickbed in a time of plague, disorientation, and deep discouragement. Where and how did he find God with him? I had the joy of talking with Philip Yancey about his new book, a modern paraphrase of Devotions called Undone, and about Philip's own story, particularly as it relates to a recent diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. Philip Yancey, as an author, has explored questions and mysteries of the Christian faith for decades in best-selling works such as Disappointment with God, Where is God When It Hurts, and What's So Amazing About Grace. Philip has written more than 25 books, and his latest release is Undone, a modern rendering of John Donne's Devotions. We'll include a link to that book in the show notes today. I also want to share with you a couple of additional quotes from Philip's bio. I write books for myself, he says. I'm a pilgrim recovering from a bad church upbringing, searching for a faith that makes its followers larger and not smaller. He also says, and I love this, I can't think of any argument against God that isn't already included in the Bible. Philip and his wife live in the foothills of Colorado. Now, ask not for whom the intro music rolls. It rolls for thee. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Do you have your own podcast, Philip?
I do not. I'm pretty limited in social media. We do a Facebook and a website blog, but I don't do, you know, my goodness, TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, any of those. Too old for that stuff.
No, I don't blame you. If there are any listeners who would like to inquire about social media jobs with the Living Church, get in touch with me. Because every time we talk about social media, everyone on staff just sort of inwardly groans because all of us are like you. None of us really love or in love with social media.
Our time scale of when people expect a response has been collapsed. So in the old days, somebody would write you a letter, and if you got back to them within a week or two, they were thrilled. Then fax came, and if you, again, you got a response within 2 or 3 days, you're quite happy. And then we got email. If you get back to them within one day, maybe they're happy. Now we've got texting, and if you don't get back to them within 1 hour, they think, did you get this? Why have you done something? And it's just that tyranny of the urgent that just crushes in. Someone sent me the other day a response, an automatic response from Tim Keller that he wrote before he died. And I haven't done this, but if you email Tim Keller, it will say, I'm happy to hear from you. I'm in heaven. We don't do email up here.
Oh, that's very precious. Philip, thank you for coming on the show today.
Well, I have researched you a little bit, and I'm impressed by this program. I think you have a very sophisticated audience and curious, and I look forward to talking to them.
Well, thank you. Guys, you got a compliment from Philip Yancey. Philip, can I just ask, do you celebrate Lent?
I do sometimes and sometimes not. This particular time I did not. And part of it was because it happened to be a very busy schedule time. I have several trips in there and I am under a clinical study for a new drug that shows some potential in helping Parkinson's disease. And exactly a year ago, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And so I knew my mind was going to be pulled in so many directions. That's probably a reason to do Lent in a very serious way, but I just didn't think I could give it the attention that I needed to, that it deserved.
You know, Philip, that actually reminds me of young mothers who are friends of mine, and their Lenten practice is to simply be a young mother.
Mm.
You know, it's like, I'm 8 months pregnant and have a year old child. My Lent is to do my day prayerfully. And that's my Lenten practice.
That's good. My favorite Lent story comes from my wife. She was working with an inner city program run out of our church. And one day a staff person came in and she was coughing, coughing, coughing. And Janet turned to her and said, "Taria, do you have a cold or something?" And she said, no, it's Lent." I said, "Well, why would Lent make you cough?" And she said, "Well, I gave up not smoking for Lent because I feel so good when I don't smoke. I decided that I would inflict myself with smoking during Lent."
Oh, boy. Philip, I would love to jump into your journey through John Donne's devotions. And I imagine that your journey was something like Eugene Peterson's journey through scripture while he was writing the paraphrase of the Bible, The Message, because Undone is essentially a paraphrase of the devotions for people who might otherwise be put off by reading the 17th century language. And you really wanted to make this accessible, this great work of prayer and reflection on suffering. Can you give our audience a little background on this?
I actually had this idea for a book more than 40 years ago, before I had ever written a book, yes. And I was investigating the problem of pain. You know, we all wonder these questions, classic questions about why these bad things happen and how God is involved and things like that. Then I came across John Donne's devotions. I read it and I thought, man, he answered most of these questions. This is great. And whenever one of my friends would start talking about the problem of pain, I'll say, "Oh, I got the book for you." And I kept a stack in the closet and I'd give them a book. And then I would later ask them, "What, did you read this book?" And they would say, "Well, you know, a couple pages." "What? It's great stuff. You got to keep reading." It's pretty hard to get into.
Oh, no.
And they're right. I counted up. I think the longest sentence I found was 234 words, one sentence in John Donne. And then there's all this kind of crazy scientific stuff. They weren't sure that the earth revolved around the sun in those times. And state-of-the-art medicine involved things like bleeding, you know, attaching leeches, putting pigeons next to your mouth to whisk away the evil vapors coming from it, things like that. So a modern reader
will insurance pay for that?
Yeah, a modern reader reads that and thinks, "What is this weird stuff?" But this book has been in print for 400 years. This is actually the 400th anniversary, 2024. And there's great stuff there. "No man is an island for whom the bell tolls." You know, some of those have become famous phrases. So that's when I wanted to make it accessible. And I did a few sample chapters and it just sat in a file drawer for more than 40 years. And when the pandemic hit, I started seeing these books come out right away, "God in the Pandemic, God in the Coronavirus," within 60 days. And I thought, who could come up with a perspective worth thinking about in 60 days? Here's somebody who lived through a much worse pandemic. And 400 years later, we still go to him for insight, for comfort. If I could just get rid of those blocks that keep people from turning the page, keep people from reading it and engaging with it, that could be a service. And so I spent most of a summer during the pandemic doing that.
And as John was doing his own writing project, he had what he thought was the plague, And he thought he was dying. He may well have been dying, and, you know, and, but eventually, spoiler alert, he did recover from that particular illness in which he wrote his devotions. Would you mind bringing us up to speed a little bit to this moment in which he's alone in his room, he's quarantined, he's terribly ill, his symptoms keep changing and moving around, the doctors keep trying different things, he's not sleeping well, he's not eating well, he's got the sweats, and he's pretty sure he's going to die. And and he begins these reflections. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about this time in John's life?
Yes. He gave one sermon and he began it with a quote from Lamentations that said, "I am the man who hath known affliction." And that's the summary of John Donne's life. He was born into a Roman Catholic family at a time when they were not in the favor of the court. You know, they went back and forth in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. While the Reformation was going on various places and King Henry VIII and all that. And he was born Catholic. And in King James's time, that was not a good thing. So here he was, a very bright guy. Everybody knew that. They allowed him to go to Oxford and Cambridge, but he couldn't get a degree there because of his Catholic faith. He did a tour in Europe. He saw wars. He was one of those cavaliers going around with a sword, possibly fathered a child while he was over there, was known for his erotic poetry, was just trying to find himself, kind of a dandy. And he was bright enough to be in the court of King James, but because of his Catholic background, he just couldn't do that. So he converted, he became an Anglican. And of course, there's a lot of gossip about, well, yeah, right, there's a conversion of convenience. He wanted a job, so he converted.
There are worse reasons.
There are worse. Around that time, he fell in love, and this really turned a corner for him. She was only 17, and it became Anne Donne. But her father did not approve of her marrying a Catholic, or at least a former Catholic. So he had John Donne thrown into jail. And John Donne wrote his shortest, pithiest poem at that time. It goes like this: John Donne, Anne Donne, Undone. It's the title of my book. And then he finally got a break. People started believing that he was good clergy material. And in the middle of those plague days, London needed a spiritual leader. A third of the city had died. A third had fled into the countryside. And the people who were left were living in fear and terror. And they had all these questions. What is God punishing us? There are these prophets roaming the streets with their easy answers on why it was happening. And John Donne was the man for the times. He stood in the pulpit and the church was packed and he delivered these beautiful, eloquent sermons. And right at the peak of that, he fell ill. And it looked like the end of his life. It looked like he was succumbing to the plague, as they had. You know, we've got this funny word, invalid, which is actually spelled the same as you could pronounce it, invalid. Oh, and yeah. I think that's probably what John Donne felt. Okay, I know I'm an invalid, but am I now invalid? Finally, I found a purpose in life to bring comfort to a city in turmoil and chaos. And now this has happened to me. And that was the setting for when he wrote. You mentioned the state of his body when he wrote. One of the worst things for me, as I read his state, was that he had no access to his resources. So he had to write this without being able to go to the books that he had absorbed or even to the Bible. He had to just sit there and pen it by hand with nothing but a piece of paper and his ink pen.
I think I probably in a Disney movie or something, I heard, you know, books compared to being windows to the outside world. So you're starved of relationships. I mean, your relationship at that point is with your doctor, basically, whatever doctors are brave enough to come and treat you. The sounds you can hear outside, what you can see through your window. And then I would think your books, but he didn't even have his books. Correct. That shocks me. I don't know why that, I think because, Philip, I'm thinking what it must feel like to be left in a room, to be that ill, to think you're dying, and to not have any way to escape. You're even sort of more thrown back on yourself as if you were on a deserted island. I just think of other times and places where people might be that isolated. That is extreme. That's extreme isolation to sort of just be left with your own thoughts, your own memories, and how you not go crazy.
You use the word island, and I think that's what suffering does. It islands us. It makes us feel like we're the only ones who know what this is like, and we're right. Nobody knows what my pain is like. I can try to sympathize, but I can't really feel what another person is feeling. And in fact, his most famous meditation came right out of that. You talk about the window. He had a window open, and he heard a bell toll. And in those days, they had bells that announced that a person was about to die, a bell that announced that a person did die, and a bell to announce when a funeral service was going to be. So John Donne heard this bell, and his first thought was, oh, no, I'm going to die. They just haven't told me yet. The bell is about me. And then the more he thought about it, he thought, well, no, it's probably one of my parishioners. And here I should be there bringing comfort, and yet I can't. And then he realized in that moment how self-absorbed he had been. He was only thinking about himself. And in that meditation, he says, you know, if a piece of dirt gets washed away from Europe, Europe is the less. Europe is diminished. And that for whom the bell tolls is a beautiful passage on caring for others going through their suffering instead of just being totally absorbed on yours. That was a turning point for him. And it really changed the devotions from being that, why me, to what can I learn? What can I take away? And especially what can I give to others who might go through this?
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. No man is an island. Ask not for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. That came out of that very moment. That's beautiful. And it's lovely the way that profound suffering takes this turn around a corner and flips into a sort of empathy with everything that suffers. And the potential for sanctification of sanctity, sort of this deeper sanctity. And I'd love to talk more about that with you in a few moments. But I am curious first, as someone who's written extensively on pain and suffering, you said that, quote, nothing prepared you for this book. So what surprised you most when you first read Devotions? And then maybe what continues to surprise you?
A couple of things. Well, what surprised me when I first read it was I had been researching, reading some of the great books on suffering and pain. And there's an irony at work because in a day when there was no anesthesia, think about that, when there were no antibiotics, when there were no knee replacements, you know, if you felt a pain, you just had to live with it. For most of human history, this has only been the last two centuries or so where we've really had some remedies. And in those days, people were not nearly as shrill and angry as they are now. When they would write about the problem of pain, they would usually be defending God rather than wrestling with God. So I had read a number of the classics. I'm talking about John Calvin and Luther and even going back, Augustine, people like that. If you read what they say about suffering, they're very gentle toward God. They don't haul him into court. John Donne put on the boxing gloves. Much like Job, he said, this just ain't right. There is no way I can accept this as just. Here I am. I'm finally in a place where I can really help you, God. And what do? You put me flat on my back and I have to lie here and listen to these, to my parishioners die one by one. Show me the justice here. And so that's what struck me. It was one of the first bold wrestling matches with God. There was a play made out of the book of Job a number of years ago called Arms Too Short to Box with God. Your arms too short to box with God. And Job and following him, John Donne, belt. I don't care how short my arms are. God deserves a big tweak in the nose, and I'm going to give it to him. So that's what struck me at first, the way it stood out. Just, he had that 20th century anger.
Mm-hmm.
This world is problematic, and you need to explain things to us. When I picked it up again, 40 some years later, what struck me was a kind of a reversal. We tend to think science is the permanent stuff. Once you get the law of gravity down, once you get how planets go around the stars and those kind of things down, you think that's hard science. And if you go to university, things like psychology, sociology, philosophy, those are the soft sciences. Those are just opinions, you know. Well, here you've got this treatise from John Donne, and the science in it was state of the art at the time. Nobody would take seriously anything in the medicine of John Donne's day, 400 years later. But John Donne articulated what I have heard again and again from people, either people who write about the problem of pain or people who go through it. He surfaced the questions that we all have when we go through hard times. So in a reversal there, the hard science wasn't very hard at all, but the soft, what we think of as the soft sciences, that's what endured and endures to this day.
And part of what John is doing is he's looking at himself almost in the way a scientist would, making minute observations about his own body, his own sufferings, and then applying those to society or to the heavens or to the way physics work or other creatures operate. Now, he's spending a lot of time with his own sick body. So what other material does he have? Mm-hmm. But one thing I'd love to chat with you about for a moment is the way he finds analogies mm-hmm. from his own body to his soul, from his body to nature, from his body to society. So here's one example. He says, he gets these bruises on his chest. And he's reflecting on them. And your paraphrase quotes him as saying, "May I look on these spots on my chest and on my soul, not as the pinches of death," which is what the scientists of the time would call it, "but rather as the constellations of the sky to direct my contemplation to that place where your son is seated at your right hand." He sees bruises on his chest. He thinks of the stars. Where do the stars point? So where do these bruises point? To the Son of God seated at the Father's right hand. It's like, how does a person come to look through this kind of lens and to be able to pay this kind of spiritual attention, even to a moment of being so alone and being alone with your own body, with your own sickness? How does a person develop this?
And he's a poet, first of all. So when doctors are examining him, he thinks of cartographers. That's how he feels about these doctors standing over his body. Or at one point, he thinks of himself as a page who's a chapter in a book. And one day that will be translated into a different language. And that's the spiritual application. So he does that throughout. And of course, he starts with his self-absorbed attention to his own body, because we do that. We do that when we're sick. We do that as we age. My goodness, I'm in a clinical trial for Parkinson's disease, and I have to pay attention to my body every day. You know, I have to check in with a smartphone every time I take a pill, and I have to do these exercises that some smartphone tells me what to do. And all of us will go through that at some point if we live long enough. And you have to pay attention to those things. That's part of life. I did several books, Amber, with a medical doctor, Dr. Paul Brand, who was a surgeon based in India. And he worked with leprosy, which is a disease where people don't feel pain. And because they don't feel pain, they hurt themselves without knowing it. And he said, pain is not the enemy of the body. What we should do is to use pain to care for the weakest part of the body. So if there's one part that's not working, often there are 99 parts that aren't work that are working, but we devote our attention to that one part. You know, if it's a broken arm or if it's an ingrown toenail, you know, you can't stop thinking about it. You pay attention to it. And Dr. Brand would make that application to the body of Christ as well. So who should we be paying attention to in our prayers and our concern? Ukraine, Sudan, the famine going on there, Gaza and Israel, those places. That's what we should be doing. And pain is something that alerts us to something that's not working the way it's supposed to. Mm-hmm. It's the language that our body uses to get our attention. Mm-hmm. And that applies on several levels, certainly the physical level, and then the spiritual and societal level as well.
Hey there, podcast listener. If you've listened to the podcast for a while, you probably know that The Living Church is not just a podcast. Oh no, my friend. TLC is a publishing ministry with a unique magazine, independent church news reporting, a stellar theology blog, resources for parish ministry, many of them free. I could go on. Stop me now. We're rooted in the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion, but we have a big heart for the unity of all God's people. You know that I love that you're here, but I don't want you to just stay in the podcast space and miss out on other ways our ministry might serve you. You can go to livingchurch.org and see what all TLC offers. How can we serve you today? One way we might serve you is coming up in September. We're hosting an event with an amazing community of friends at All Souls Episcopal Church in Oklahoma City, a conference called The Human Pilgrimage. What does it mean to be human? How do we live fully as creatures loved, limited, and liberated by God? Join the Living Church September 26th to 28th in Oklahoma City and be refreshed by 3 days of world-class keynotes, friendship, and meditation on who we are as creatures in Christ. Right now, you also get 15% off all tickets with the promo code EARLYBIRD. Go to livingchurch.org/events for more information and to buy your tickets. And I hope to see you there. As we're talking about this, it seems to me like an enormous gift that God gives us that the matter of our own bodies is such a rich mine for understanding spiritual truths, that we so easily allegorize our own bodies. And yes, that can become obsessively self-absorbed. That has its own problems, as every gift does. But I don't think it's ever occurred to me before what a gift it is that even if we were alone with ourselves, which we all are at some point or another, either psychologically or physically, we're all isolated at some point. And in those moments, even in those moments, what could become self-absorption can become a rich mine for understanding weakness or pain or prayer or God's intentions toward us.
Over the years, I've interviewed a lot of people because they've written about pain. A lot of them tell me about their journey with suffering. And looking back, I just came up with this phrase a year or so ago that I was thinking through the people I've interviewed. And that is, goes like this: pain redeemed impresses me more than pain removed. And when pain happens, when suffering happens, we want to get rid of it. go away, get out of here. But as I really go through the people I've gotten to know who live with suffering that won't go away, there is a redemptive aspect. And Dunn spells that out very clearly, what he can learn, the way he became so much more compassionate and empathetic. He became a much more sensitive vicar, pastor after that. And it's natural to want to get rid of pain, but pain is serving a purpose. And, you know, there's a phrase from C.S. Lewis, The Problem of Pain, that is, to me, is a little problematic the way it's interpreted often. He said that God whispers to us in our good times, but uses the megaphone of pain to speak to us. I don't think that God is up there, down there, wherever, shouting through a megaphone, "I'm going to show him, I'm going to make him suffer, watch this." That's not the God I see in Jesus around people who are suffering. I would change that image from a megaphone to a hearing aid. It's up to us. Mm. Some people will turn that hearing aid off, or you could turn it up and say, what can I learn? How can this be a redemptive thing? How can it be a growth experience?
Yeah. And that's such a tightrope to walk, isn't it? Trying not to say, you know, they're better because of the cancer. What, you know, what's the way to say it that really gets at the truth of what's happening? And Dunn does this. So you give a little commentary about his belief that, yes, all things come from the hand of God, that there are times when God does punish sin, for example. And so an affliction might come as a punishment for sin. In some circumstances, that's just a great mystery. And that God is always present, that God always knows that what's happening right now is being permitted by him. And yet, as I think you mentioned before in our conversation, he is resisting going full on Calvin here. He's resisting Calvin in some ways. And so one way he puts it is, O eternal and most gracious God, you are the God of security and the enemy of security, both. Mm. And part of what he's getting at here is that everything that God permits can be purgative and sanctifying for us, not only physical pain and physical suffering, which would be enough, but also psychological suffering like fear. He even specifically addresses fear as being damaging on the one hand. God has not given us a spirit of fear, and to be resisted on the one hand, but on the other hand, if you can't avoid it, it can be purgative. So as you walked this, and I know that you know this tightrope I'm talking about, as you walked that tightrope with John Donne, what did you discover?
Have you ever had Kate Bowler on your program?
I have not. Okay. I haven't had her on the podcast yet.
Well, she's written a couple of best-selling, New York Times number one best-selling books. The first one was Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies They Tell You, or something like that.
Yep.
And then a recent one, Have a Beautiful, Terrible Day. And I love John Donne because I think he could write a book called Have a Beautiful, Terrible Day. You know, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And fear is a great example because he does speak of it as damaging. And he kind of goes through all of his various fears. And that's what's beautiful about this book, because when I'm in a hospital bed or waiting for a procedure or something like that, I go through exactly the stages that John Donne sets out so well. And of course, he wants the fears to go away, but they're legitimate fears. You know, the people whispering in the hallways, and are they not telling him the truth? Is he really going to die tomorrow? You know, and they're just hiding it from him. And he works through that and finally decides, you know what? The question isn't so much what is worth fearing. The question is, what is the antidote to fear? And the only antidote Donne can come up with is trust. Do you trust your doctor or not? Do you trust your friends who say they'll look after you, take care of you, or not? Do you trust God or not? And finally, he decides, I'm going to fear God, because I've got two choices. I can either fear God in the proper kind of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes way, or I can fear everything else. Mm. And I just don't have the energy to fear everything else. So I'm going to fear God.
Trust is a decision. It's taking a particular stance and deciding to act from there, mm-hmm. rather than being unmoored.
Right. And I think part of that is it gives us agency. It's a choice that we make.
Right.
I can choose to trust. It's easy when you're recovering just to feel like you're a victim. People come in and prod you and poke you and do all these things they do in hospitals. And you just feel like a piece of meat. And this trust business, choosing where and how to exercise your trust is a key part of agency that restores your human capacity.
Wow, that's beautiful. I would love to talk for a moment about your own diagnosis. I think this is sort of remarkable that this is the 400th anniversary of the devotions, and this is the first anniversary your diagnosis with Parkinson's. Now, we see in John Donne's life, and we saw in the pandemic, that illness, when it's contagious, profoundly affects community and friendships. But I would venture to guess that even when it's not contagious, it profoundly affects community and friendships. I've been wondering what you are experiencing and what you hope from your family your friends and your community over time as you live with Parkinson's, as you're in the in these relationships of trust? What do you hope from your community over time?
My first response when I got the diagnosis was, I just don't believe this. It can't be true. And I wrote a column about it that was published in Christian News Today called Dislabeled, because I felt I don't deserve this label. And then I started experiencing some of the symptoms of Parkinson's. I ran into a tree while skiing, and I had clearly given orders to my legs. I'm a pretty good skier. Turn right. And they disobeyed. And then I realized, this is for real. This is my life. And Parkinson's is a one-way disease. It only gets worse, doesn't get better. So once you lose an ability, you don't get it back. The neurons stop firing. So you can do some things to forestall, and medication helps as well. But it's a fact. I am different now. I have Parkinson's. So what I wanted to express in that column was, I'm still Philip. I'm not Philip with Parkinson's. I'm still Philip at the core. Yes, I do have this Parkinson's, but don't just look at me through that lens. I'm a lot more than that. I'm everything I used to be, and then something else on top of it. And we're uncomfortable. I realize how uncomfortable I have been in general around disabled people.
Yeah.
I have a brother 2 years older who went through a stroke and is seriously affected. And I've learned a lot from him. I've learned a lot just by watching how people respond to him. And I found that the only really honest people are children. They'll go up to him and say, "Don't you know how to walk?" Or he'll say something and they say, "You talk funny," And I mean, he knows that. He just laughs. But adults are too polite. They're too proper. So they talk in, like this around the corner. And that's much worse. It's really much worse to be talked about. And John Donne himself expresses that. He sees the doctors out in the hallway. And it just kind of makes him mad. Why don't they be honest with me? So I want an honest, transparent person. In fact, I had some inklings that there was something wrong with my body. And that put off going to a doctor. I'm a man, we don't do that. So until a couple of friends, one of them said to me, "Do you have the slows?" And the other one said, "Man, something's wrong with you. You're walking like an old man." And that got my attention like nothing else. So I want people to be honest and transparent. And it's okay to ask questions. What is it like? What do you hate the worst? What's a bad day for you look like? That's what I want for my friends. I want them to affirm I am the same person, but there are some things about me that are different. Mm-hmm. And that's okay for you to acknowledge, because I know that better than you do. So just treat me like an authentic person. Don't talk about me behind my back. Ask me if you have a question, and I'm happy to talk about it.
And on that note, there were some funny things for John Donne community-wise that actually opened up. In fact, after his recovery, didn't people note a real difference in how he was pastoring and interacting with people?
Absolutely. Not only that, he also was aware of how precious life is and how it can be taken away at any moment. So it energized his experience of the moment by moment acts of living.
Yeah. I'm curious whether you've had any similar experience so far, and whether any kind of fellowship or community has opened up for you in just these beginning stages of Parkinson's. I wonder what moments or doors of fellowship are opening, or you suspect might, as this develops.
Yes. Shortly after, I guess the first plane trip I took after I got the diagnosis, I had a pretty good seat. It was just the row behind first class, not in first class, but I could kind of see them. And I noticed there was this one man who had trouble eating. His wife was helping him out. He was just uncoordinated. And then when we landed and pulled up to the gate and the bell dinged, then he kind of stood up and he fell back down, and he stood up again. And he was trying to get his his carry-on case out of the overhead bin. And it was just taking him forever. The people behind me were growling and grumbling, and I got a plane to catch. You know, I got a tight connection here. What's going on up there? And I watched this man and I realized that could be me in a few years. And it's easy to be one of those grumblers saying you're making me late. But I have to do what you're supposed to do. Well, disabled means you can't always do what you're supposed to do or what you want to do. And I started being aware of that, the people in the wheelchairs, the people in the scooters and in the carrying the canes, using canes, going through the airport, wherever I am out in public. My wife instinctively goes to those people. She's a social worker. Mm. I kind of avoided them just because they made me feel awkward. Mm. And that's the worst response. And I'm learning from that. And then with a disease like Parkinson's, there are now about 1 million people in the United States. So there are support groups and exercise groups. The exercise is very important in keeping Parkinson's at bay as much as you can. And fortunately, because of the pandemic, a lot of that is on Zoom YouTube channels. So I can stay at home and go through a group exercise routine day after day after day. It probably would be better if I had the time to go and do it in person and to be in one of those Parkinson's support groups. I had so many deadlines facing me and the clinical trial was taking up so much time, I just couldn't carve that in. But because I'm a public figure in my writing, I've heard from a lot of people with some of their crackpot ideas about I should be doing. Uh-oh. And some of them very helpful ideas.
Hopefully you will not hear anyone from the Living Church podcast community suggesting that you put pigeons on your face to take away your vapors.
Right. Although I like animals, that might be fun. So.
And I also thought, then again, some Living Church folks are pretty quirky. They might actually suggest that.
Yeah. So there is a community available for me, and I may well rely on that. And I appreciate those who have written me and said, try this, try that. I need that. And some of the things that people have suggested have been very helpful to me.
Philip, I think this is a good Lenten meal for people to chew on, from devotional practice to maybe doing hospital visits to caring for friends and family. I hope that you all have enjoyed this conversation today as much as I have. I've been speaking with author Philip Yancey. Philip, thank you so much for being with me today.
It's been a pleasure. Appreciate your work.
Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. In 2 weeks, come back for an interview with the director of Al Ali Arab Hospital in Gaza, Suhaila Tazari. This is a short but very special episode recorded live at the Episcopal Parish Network Conference in Houston, and you won't want to miss it. Until then, our producer is Leslie Thompson, and I'm Amber Noel, your host. It's been good to be with you. Peace.